Grazie Roberto, grazie Antonio per questa introduzione generosissima. E a Roberto, che è un amico caro e che mi ha invitato a questo convegno, a questo seminario. È un piacere immenso d'essere avec voi tutti, però il mio italiano non è abbastanza forte per trattare di soggetti un po' complicati. Allora vado a fare la conferenza in inglese, lentamente, però se qualcosa voi non capisce qualcosa, non capiscono qualcosa tutti, don't be ashamed to raise your hand.
Quindi fate domande, bloccate pure la presentazione e non avete paura, insomma, non avete paura.
Raise your hand if you don't understand, and Roberto will explain it to you in Italian, because he knows the subject very well. And so you can see me, I'll stand up for a while, but I may sit down somewhere along the line, so don't be surprised. This treaty, so-called Transatlantic Treaty on Trade and Investment, is a complicated animal in some ways. It's a complicated subject. But in others, it is very simple, because it has been in preparation for 25 years. It began in the early 1990s, and the idea was to bring together the transnational corporations from both sides of the Atlantic. So 70 companies came together from the United States and Europe in something they called the Transatlantic Business Dialogue. And they began working in about 1995, about 20 years ago, and little by little, they prepared the ideal treaty that they wanted to obtain, particularly from Europe at that time. The idea was to harmonize the two economies. This transatlantic business dialogue became bigger and bigger, and eventually it became something called the Transatlantic Economic Council. And this council is a political entity. They say that on their website, or at least they used to say that on their website. But I looked at it 2 days ago, and it doesn't say this anymore. What it said was, we are a political entity, and that's true, because they're sponsored by the European Commission and the US Department of Commerce, and our goal is to harmonize and to integrate the economies of the United States and Europe. Yes, please.
Sorry, do it have any special significance?
I'm not going to be able to hear you, so if you need a, why don't you, that's fine, thank you.
Does the fact that they just raise the, we are a political entity, mean something right now? Did they erase it, did they cancel it from their website?
It means that they have a political goal, and that goal is to integrate, as they said, and this paragraph isn't there anymore. They said we want to harmonize, and that always means on whoever's terms, harmonize and integrate the two economies. So I don't know anyone who voted, I don't know any Europeans or any Americans who voted to integrate our economies, or if, you know, I don't think it's a good idea, but that is what they said they do. That's their aim, this Transatlantic Economic Council. So this is nothing new. And you're all too young, I think, to remember something called the MAI. In Italian, it was the mai, and Italians were saying, diciamo mai al mai. You're too young to remember this. This is in 97, 98. And we did say mai al mai, and we won. The corporations wanted to do many things that are now in the TTIP, but they didn't win. But they always come back. They always come back with the same desires, the same strategies, and the same goals that they want to obtain from Europe. So that's where we are now. But they are, this time, I want to give you some good news because I'm going to give you a lot of bad news afterwards. But on Monday, Greenpeace published 250 pages of documents. You've read about this. And I have not been able to go through them all, obviously. They published at noon on Monday, and here we are Wednesday evening. But these documents show that everything that we as critics have been saying is absolutely true, and that the Commission will never again be able to say, these people are mythomaniacs, these people are making it up, they don't understand anything. No, everything that we have been saying turns out to be true and turns out to be in the texts. If you read them, you won't have the courage to read them all. I mean, this is my job, so I try to do it, but I wouldn't wish these documents on anybody. This is not part of an academic assignment. But you can get the gist of things, and I will try to give you the gist of what it is that they want. And why the European, I want to explain why the Americans want certain things and why the Europeans seem to be really giving in. They seem to be answering most of the demands of the Americans without telling us, of course, but so that they will be able to present this document directly to the European Parliament without citizens knowing about what's in it. The lack of transparency is one of the first things that we have criticized, and rightly so. And even our politicians, the members of Parliament in our different countries, are not able to read these documents. The MEPs, the members of the European Parliament, can read the documents, or parts of them, if they go to a special room in Brussels, or if they go to the American embassy in their capital. And there they will be met by people who will watch them, by people who will say, you cannot use a photocopier, you cannot take pictures with your telephone, you cannot use a computer. Here is some paper and a pencil, and you can write things down, but that's it. That is not anybody's idea of transparency. And even the members of our governments, even our trade minister, is supposed to go to Brussels. This is insane. If the French minister wants to read the documents, he's supposed to go to Brussels. This is completely pazzo. So that is a little bit of the history. Now, what is it that the Americans want? Geopolitically, I'm sure you know that President Obama has done what he calls the pivot to Asia. He wants to have the TTP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and he wants to then have the TTIP if The United States is here. Here is Asia. 11 countries, plus the United States, have already signed up for the TTP, for the Asian part. If Europe accepts this agreement, that will mean that nearly two-thirds of world GDP is covered, and of trade. So that is a huge piece of the world. It includes Japan. It includes the major economies of the world, except it does not include China or Russia or Brazil or any of the BRICS, South Africa. This is an agreement which, if the Americans manage to get both signatures, and they've already got the TTIP, the TTP signed up, then they will have the control over regulations, which they will then be able to impose upon the whole world. Because they will be in a position, geopolitically, to say, ah, you don't agree with us? Well, that's too bad. Go elsewhere, because all of the other governments have agreed that we will do things in such and such a way. And this seems to me extremely dangerous. Unfortunately, the ministers and the people in the countries that of Asia did not, many were against it, but they did not protest enough. They did not have the fortune to get leaks. So they are more or less set up for this agreement, unless the Congress refuses it, which is already a possibility, because there's a lot of skepticism now about free trade agreements in the United States. I could give you the reasons, mostly because of the NAFTA, the agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico, which has been a disaster for employment. It has been a disaster for Mexican farmers. It has been a great loss in jobs, industrial jobs, in the United States. And many politicians are therefore against it. But what do they, and then, of course, if they get the TTIP, they have a very strong trading partner. But to do that, they want two major things that we, the protesters, are very much against. The first major thing they want is something called ISDS, which stands for Investor to State Dispute Settlement. If an investor, well, let me start a bit before that. There are already about 3,400 bilateral treaties. A treaty between, the first one was in 1959, it was between Germany and Pakistan, and since then, individual states have been making trade agreements with other individual states. And in virtually all of these, the investor-to-state dispute settlement system is in the texts. Now, maybe you can justify this. If you're talking about the courts of Pakistan or the courts of the Congo, you can say, okay, their courts are not dependable, they may be totally corrupt, and we have to have a dispute regulation system that is trustworthy, and so we have to have a private system. And that's what ISDS is. It is a system of private jurisdiction in which an investor can sue a sovereign state. You all know the word sue? Bring to trial. An investor can bring a sovereign state to trial if the investor believes that some measure, some law, or some law of the government has in some way harmed their present or even future profits. Now, the state cannot bring a lawsuit against the investor, only the investor against the state. They go before a tribunal, often at the World Bank, where you have three private lawyers who are arbitrators, very well paid, with private lawyers to defend on both sides. There is no appeal, their decision is final, and they decide on whatever grounds, but it's often enough for an investor to say, this is in the text, my legitimate expectations were not met. I expected to be able to do this or that. The state told me I couldn't do it, and therefore I am bringing a lawsuit and I am demanding X millions and sometimes billions in compensation. Now, this is something the Americans want very much, the Europeans less, but the Europeans seem to be accepting this. Although there was so much protest that Mrs. Malmström, the commissioner for trade, was obliged to invent something new, which she calls the International Court of something or other. But it's the same thing. Don't bother with it, because it has the same sorts of provisions, except that there's an appeal and that there are panels of permanent arbitrators, but it's still entirely private. So that's one thing that the Americans definitely want to get. Now, this is perhaps the first part that I will say about human rights and just plain rights of ordinary people are going to be called into question. We already have many examples, and they come from the bilateral treaties. There are now 600 and practically, I think, 650 cases of this kind. They accelerate every year. Every year there's more and more. If we have the TTIP, not only will be there thousands of new investors, but also all of the investors that are already in Europe, and there are a great many of them, they too will benefit from this law. So, since there's already $3 trillion worth of investment between Europe and the United States and vice versa, that is an enormous number of possible lawsuits against governments. Now, let me give you some examples. Roberto has mentioned already the Trans-America pipeline, the Keystone pipeline, it's called. The company, the Trans-Canada company, when Obama, because there was so much protest, said, okay, we cancel this pipeline, which was going to bring the dirtiest possible fuel from Canada, tar sands fuel. So we cancel it. So TransCanada says, you have violated my legitimate expectations, and they are suing the United States for $15 billion, which the United States can afford if they lose. But imagine what happens to a small and relatively weak country if they have a lawsuit or several lawsuits against them. They're not going to pass that law because they are threatened with so many fines that they can't. It's too expensive. This is what we call the chilling factor. It makes you nervous and cold, and then you prefer not to pass the law. So examples of this. Any attempt to reduce the use of fossil fuels can be used against the state because the fossil fuel producers are what they are. In Ecuador, the Chevron company wanted to drill for oil in a protected area, ecologically protected. And the government said, no, you can't. And Chevron said immediately, but we are a drilling company. You knew that when we invested. And we are trying to save the most ecologically important parts of our country, and you can't drill. The result, a suit for $1.8 billion, which Chevron won. $1.8 billion. Now, that's about, I tried to look it up, and I'm not sure of this, but it's about a third to a half of Ecuador's budget for education or health. Yes?
I'm sorry, but doesn't this kind of agreement intervene somehow with the state's sovereignty to call policies for its own country, like economic policies? I mean,
yes.
For example,
yes.
Is that legal?
I'll give you some more examples. An economic one. Egypt decides to raise the minimum wage, which was very much, needed. The Veolia company from France, which has contracts for collecting waste and whatever, said, our legitimate expectations of having to pay our workers so much have been violated, and we are bringing suit. This hasn't been decided, I think. This lawsuit has not been decided yet. What has been decided is about half of the 650 some that have been decided, and the statistics are that 37% have been given the state a victory. The rest, the 63% remaining, have either been decided against the state, or the state and the corporation came together and they made a deal. And we don't know for how much. But the state had to pay something. Maybe it didn't have to pay what the corporation was demanding, but they paid something. And what's more, they have to pay the costs. So, and that means who pays the cost? All of you, if you pay taxes, your parents pay taxes. It's the citizens who pay the costs. So there have been other cases in the fossil fuel area. There is one in Quebec where the Lone Pine Company, which happens to be Canadian, but since a Canadian company is not a foreign investor in Canada, they use their U.S. subsidiary to sue Canada, which you can do. A local company cannot sue the state, but a foreign company, yes. So they use their U.S. subsidiary, and they want $250 million because they want to frack in the St. Lawrence River Basin. And the Quebec government has said, we don't authorize fracking, particularly there. The Ecuador case, the Lone Pine case, there are others, but I should probably move on a bit. The other thing, so is ISDS clear to everyone how you can use it? You see that this is a direct threat against democracy because it takes away from the judiciary the power to regulate in a legal way and create precedent and so on. This power is removed to a private court. And as I said, you can say this is okay, maybe, if it's Italy and the Congo, because we're not very sure about the courts in the Congo. But you can't say that about the U.S. system of justice or the Italian one. At least I hope not. I don't think that's possible, and I would trust a European court's system of justice. One more example on health. The Slovakia government, right after they became free of any Russian influence, decided to privatize the health system because everybody was in a furore of privatizing everything because the Russians, of course, hadn't allowed that. So we privatized the health system and it's a disaster. And the following government tries to take back the health system and put it in the public domain again. I think it's two Dutch companies, isn't it? It's two Dutch companies.
I know of Achmea.
Achmea, and I think there's another one. Anyway, one or two major health insurance providers from Holland have brought a suit against Slovakia. So it's a threat against the judicial system. It is also a threat against the legislative system because it takes away the capacity of lawmakers to make laws in fear of this kind of action, which they have to consider. And it has a chilling effect on the executive not to make certain kinds of laws, whether it is about the environment, about the health system, or whatever. The other thing that the United States is absolutely pushing for is something they call regulatory cooperation. But in fact, regulatory cooperation means harmonizing the rules, and there we have the harmonizing of the Transatlantic Economic Council, so that everybody follows the same rules. The problem there is, of course, that if you harmonize the rules, you are asking for the rules to go down. And since in most areas, not all, but most areas, Europe has higher standards than the United States. But here we have a really difficult problem because the European system and the American system, the basis of regulation, those two systems are completely different. In the United States, you regulate when you are convinced that something has passed your regulatory department. Otherwise, you put the product on the market, but your regulators, whether it's the Food and Drug Administration or whether it's the Car Safety Administration or whatever, it has to pass your agency, but that agency has instructions from the Congress. And the instructions are not only extremely difficult to apply, take a hugely long time, but they are also based on what they call it cost-benefit analysis. But they make the regulator, like we'll take Food and Drug Administration. They say, you have to give me an assessment of what exactly this product is, and you have to give me any alternative you can find to regulating it. So this is a very long and time-consuming process. Sometimes the regulator is only allowed 3 months to make it. And the result of this is that very few products are refused in the United States. The European system is to... I'm sorry, I've come with a cold. The European system is based on what is called the precautionary principle. When you're not sure if something is dangerous or not, but there are signs that it is dangerous, then you say no, unless it can be proved otherwise that it's not dangerous. So the precautionary principle puts the burden of proof on the manufacturer, and it is up to that manufacturer who wants to put the product on the market to prove that it is safe for people to eat or to use as medicine or to breathe, or it's safe for public health, it's safe for the environment, and fits the laws of the country as they are. So, those two systems clash because the Americans put the burden of proof on the regulating agencies, yes, but also to a great degree on lawsuits. This is why General Motors had to recall over 1 million cars in 2014-15 because these cars were simply stopping. The ignition turned off, the car stops in the middle of a crossroads, or it stops on the auto route, and people were being killed. Huge accidents. Even the Car Safety Agency recognizes 13 deaths. But how did we find out about this? Because the New York Times did an inquiry, not because the government admitted it. And we found out because the New York Times reporters went to the Car Safety Administration, which said, we got a lot of complaints and there were accidents, but we got about a dozen a month for years. We got about a dozen complaints a month, and we didn't think it was enough to start regulation again, so we just let it go. Many people killed, and General Motors had to recall the cars. If that had happened in Europe, I think the outcome would have been absolutely different. And if it had gone through with the very first intimations that there was something wrong, they would have done something. I'm not very favorable to the European Commission, but in this case, there were several lawsuits, including group lawsuits, and the government did not act. So the precautionary principle is a basic human rights principle to protect consumers, to protect sick people, to protect the environment, and in general, I'd say that's the biggest connection with human rights. Now, with the TTIP, they want to change the whole system so that Europe is on a non-precautionary principle basis, which up to now, as we found in the Greenpeace documents, this comes out, Europe is quite close to accepting this. Now, in any trade negotiation, there are common interests, but there are fewer common interests than offensive and defensive interests. Each side wants to get what they most want. And among the things that the United States most wants is regulatory cooperation. They also want European agriculture. And I should say a word about European agriculture because it is true that here we still have quite high tariffs against American food imports. And that is because it is quite probable that our farmers could not compete against American farm products which are subsidized. The government gives huge subsidies to the farmers. There aren't very many of them, and the farms in the United States, an Italian would not call it a farm, they would call it a factory or something close, a biological factory. You see, if you see a movie about this, you will see machines which are as long as this room and which are moving forward like this, doing the harvest, doing the planting. It is totally capital intensive, and it Europeans cannot compete. Our farms are smaller. They are better run. I think I would rather eat food produced by contadini, paysans, than from an American farm. And among the regulations that this would change are the chlorine washed chickens. Chickens are killed and then they are washed with chlorine, like you put in your white laundry. You know, you might wash your t-shirt with chlorine. The meat, the beef are raised, the cows are raised with growth hormones, and it's just generally a very capital-intensive system where you don't know what the chemicals are that are used, and there's no labeling on U.S. food. So you don't know what's in it. You don't know if there's GMOs or what. Europe seems prepared to accept all of this. Now, I forget where I was because I wanted to go back from agriculture to... Sorry, this is... Do you remember where I was before? My fault. It will come. It will come to me. Don't worry. The GMOs have been genetically modified organisms have been pretty much refused by European governments. I don't know what the situation is in Italy. In France, we've refused all but just a couple of GMO products from Monsanto, which is already too many. But we do not accept GMOs, and we insist on having labels on our food so consumers can know what is in what they are eating. The Americans don't. Now, there is a new, this is something quite new, there is a new genetic technique which they call it non-invasive or something like that. This is a technique which allows you to cut with an enzyme into a plant, remove something, replace it with another gene, which can be from a completely different plant. It could be from an animal. It could be from any living thing. This is called synthetic biology. And this is quite new. And you place the new gene from something else, something quite different, in the new, in the organism that you want to change. And very often, the other genes will begin to transform themselves into the model that has just been introduced. I cannot explain this biologically any better than that, I'm sorry. But the Europeans seem to be accepting that these are not genetically manipulated organisms because it's a new technique. This too is completely crazy. Obviously, they are genetically manipulated, and even worse than breeding rice with rice, or you stay within a species. But here you don't have to stay within a given species. And the Europeans seem close to accepting this. Okay, agriculture is in danger. What else is in danger? Very quickly, because it's nearly, it's 5:30, I should stop. Or a little later, okay. The effects of this technique, they call it, I found that what it's called gene editing. Like you cross out something here in a paper or a book, and you change it to something else. Gene editing instead of editing a text or a newspaper. What has disappeared in the TTIP. No mention of labor rights, no mention of environmental rights. The effort by the US to export greater and greater quantities of fuel, fossil fuel, to Europe, that is high on their agenda. What is high on the European side? Our offensive interest in Europe, or the Commission's offensive interest, is to get the United States to give them opening to government procurement, purchases by governments. That can be purchases of anything from toilet paper in the ministries, in the departments, to bombers, to anything the government pays for. And what Europe wants is not just the federal government level of all the national laws, they want the state level, which is 50 states. And the states have rights to make their own laws in a great many areas. And so the Americans are saying, we have no capacity to force the states to change their laws. And the Europeans are saying, yes, you have. And we want municipal, state, and federal rights to government procurement, which is very big because that means a huge number of jobs. I think it's close, directly or indirectly, to half the jobs in the United States at one level or another. And this has come, there's no mention of this. So Europe was prepared to give away agriculture in exchange for government procurement. We don't know what's going to happen yet, or if it exists, I don't know, because if it's in the Greenpeace papers, I haven't read that yet. But this is a big danger for Europe as well. Because if we were to give away agriculture and lower the tariffs to practically zero, which is what the United States is asking for, then we would certainly lose at least 2-3 million farmers. America has 2.2 million farmers, and they feed the United States and a huge capacity, they have a huge capacity for export. We have close to 14 million farmers in the European Union, and we would lose, I can't estimate how many, but we do have estimates now from Friends of the Earth who have shown in a very detailed report, go to Friends of the Earth Europe and ask for the report on agriculture if this interests you, and it will tell you in detail exactly how much the prices would go down in a number of areas, including grain crops, dairy crops, meat, everything that is grown in the US. And our farmers would lose. And I do not see how they could possibly compete with the prices as they would then be. The other thing the United States wants, they want us to buy GMOs, not have labeling. They want to have access to our regulations so that they can sell whatever. They do not want any labels so consumers know what's in their food, if it's GMOs or not. But they are also telling Europe, get rid of your geographical indications. A geographical indication simply means Chianti, it means Champagne, it means Parma ham, it means anything where the tradition of a country has produced something really special using the same methods for centuries. And here I have the numbers. There are 1,561 wines and spirits which are classed by Europeans as geographical indications. There are, and wines and spirits are the most important thing. There are fruits and vegetables, and cereals are almost 30%, cheeses are almost 20%, the rest are meat, around meat and meat products and oils, mostly olive oils, about 10%, and meat is about 12%. But you see how many things our farms have produced and our traditions have produced. And maybe your grandparents contributed to producing these things. And people buy them because they have that geographical indication, because they know the quality that they're going to have. So the US says, reduce the number that you insist on. And the Europeans have done that. And instead of having 2,500 geographical indications, and the countries are mainly, guess what, Italy, Portugal, Spain, France, Germany, and Greece, southern countries mostly, and they have reduced this huge list to 50. I don't know what's on the list. We don't know. That's part of the non-transparency. But this, too, is an extremely grave danger for the economy, but also just for ordinary human beings who are not going to find food labeled with, and are going to have to be very sharp to see, because you can produce champagne in California, you can produce Parma ham in, who knows, Illinois? I don't know. And this is going to be one of the things that's on the table. So the point is, we've got to get this off the table. We have. I think there's no way to arrange this around the edges. There's no way to say okay for this, but not okay for that, because it would be, if we change our regulatory system, if the European system becomes like the American one, then the corporations are just going to, they will wipe us out. And that is their goal. I mean, they are there to win. And their economic interests are only economic. And when they talk about cost benefit, they are never talking about the cost for public health. They don't talk about the cost of pollution or the cost of using fossil fuels and so on. Let's see if I have. Well, I have those numbers too here. But a study established that regulation of waste, biodiversity, water quality, air quality, chemicals policy, and noise amounted to $200 to $300 billion a year. In other words, if we don't have those things regulated, we lose $200 to $300 billion a year, in addition to all the benefits of clean air, clean water, etc., etc. The same thing for chemicals. The United States have 83,000 chemicals in their database. How many do you think they have banned? The Europeans have banned, over the same time period, 1,200 chemicals. How many in the United States do you think have been outlawed? Five. Can we keep our regulations on chemicals? I don't think that's very sure. So, this has to be taken off the table. We have to beat it. We're doing pretty well. We're doing pretty well up to now because we tried to get a citizens initiative with the European Commission. They refused to authorize it. So we said, we'll do it ourselves. But we use the European Commission's rules, which are a citizens initiative has to gather 1 million signatures in a year's time, and those signatures have to come from 7 different countries that have met a quota which is fixed by the Commission. So in Germany, it has to be 70,000 signatures in France, 55,000 in Greece, a very few, 2,000 or 3,000. And we got not 1 million in a year, not 1 million, but 3.4 million signatures. And they came not from 7 countries, but from 21 countries. The only countries that did not meet their quota were Cyprus, Malta, and the 3 Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Everybody else met their quota. So this means that people are better and better informed about what the TAFTA, we call it the TAFTA in French, sorry, what the TTIP actually is. And it means that when people learn what is in it, they're against it. They do not want corporations running their lives. They want to have normal, democratic government, they want transparent government, and they want to be able to count on the kinds of protection to which they have become they've become used to. These are the things that we really treasure. These are things that people fought for, that our ancestors fought for over long periods. And they could all be erased in a very short time if we're not active. So the signature campaign, the Greenpeace revelations, all of this is very important because, as I said at the beginning, now they cannot say that we are talking nonsense or that we don't know what is in it, because all of this, everything we have been saying, is really in this text. We only have up to the beginning of April. If it continues, we'll have to keep going, keep campaigning. But I think it could be stopped, because now the French minister has said, we have to get out of this. The Germans, not the German government, but the German approval rating of the TAFTA. And they are the country which has been pushing the hardest. The TTIP, sorry, I keep saying TAFTA. I'm more used to talking to French audiences. The TTIP has an approval rating in Germany of only 17%. Everybody else is against it. It would be bad for small business. It would be harmful for all kinds of regulations that are important to our daily lives. And I will rest my case there. And I hope you have some questions. And I hope I haven't been too long and bored you. And I thank you very much indeed for your attention.